Good morning. I'd like to call the Senate Finance Committee to order. It's 1.5 minutes. We're getting closer to 9 o'clock. 1.5 minutes after 9 a.m. March 25th, 2008. With me today is my co-chair, Senator Hoffman. He's smiling after he got done with his big workload yesterday. Senator Olson, Senator Elton, Senator Thomas, Senator Dyson, and myself, Senator Stedman. Today we have three bills on the agenda. Senate Bill 28, limit overtime for registered nurses. Senate Bill 152, charter school funding. House Bill 125, budget planning and long-term fiscal plan. And we're going to start today with Senate Bill 28, limit overtime for registered nurses. This is the third hearing we've had on this bill. At the last meeting, we adopted a CS version T. We have already taken public testimony twice on this bill. I'm not aware of any further changes proposed. Does any member have any questions before we ask the will of the committee? Seeing none, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that Senate Finance Committee pass out CS for Senate Bill 28 / T as with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Okay, we have a motion to move the bill from committee with the fiscal notes attached and individual recommendations. Do we have objection to moving the bill? Okay, seeing no objection, we will move the bill from committee. We'll go on to the second bill on the agenda today, Senate Bill 152, charter school funding. It intends to adopt a CS, take public testimony, and then we'll see how things progress on the bill from there. Senator Hoffman, we have a motion to adopt version K.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the Senate Finance Committee adopt CS for Senate Bill 152 / K as our working document.
We have a motion to adopt version K as our working document. Do we have objection? I will object for discussion. And if we could have a bill sponsor, representative, we'll have Mr. Darwin Peterson come forward from my staff to walk through the CS's issues. And then after we take care of the CS issue, we'll move back to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Darwin Peterson, staff to Senator Stedman. The change in the CS version K is the multiplier for charter schools with an ADM of less than 150 is changed from 1.27 in the original version of the bill to 1.08 in the CS you have before you.
Okay. Do we have any questions on the change? I'll go ahead and remove my objection to adoption of the CS. You have objections?
Sorry, I was tuned out. Would you say it again, please?
Through the chair, Darwin Peterson again, staff to Senator Stedman. The change in the CS is on line 6. The original version of the bill had a multiplier for charter schools with an ADM of 150 or less at 1.27. This version of the bill reduces that multiplier to 1.08.
Yeah, so I have some questions, if I may. Why?
This was, the CS was at the request of Senator Stevens. A meeting was held in this committee about a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago, on charter schools. And after that meeting, the number that was forwarded up to the committee from the chairman of the Education Committee was 1.08. So this CS was introduced for discussion purposes.
Yeah, so that tells me how it happened. Is there somebody who can tell me why we adjusted it from 1.27 to 1.08?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, it was considered to be a more reasonable number as far as the funding level that we currently offer to charter schools in the operating budget to bring that in line. And whether or not the committee agrees with the suggestion or not is up to the committee, but that's the reason for the CS.
All right, thank you. And I, I really appreciate this bill and what I think it's trying to do. I'd like to hear from the bill's sponsor why 1.08 is now the appropriate number as a point to 1.27, except that it puts more money.
Hey, wait, so this is back up a little bit here, because I've already removed my objection to the adoption, so we'll take it that Senator Dyson objects to the adoption of the CS for discussion.
Sure, thank you.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I would probably agree with you. That is my opinion. It was considered that it may be more palatable at 1.08 and get something done rather than nothing is really the explanation. Short and to the point, I arrived at that number thinking that was a fair number, the 1.27 as a factor, but it appears that that is not going to be successful in the bill. So if it gets done at 1.08, I'm happy to have it done, is what it amounts to.
Here we have one of the representatives from Senator Stevens' office has come forward. If you want to identify yourself and speak to the issue, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens and the committee aide on the Senate Special Committee on Education. This is before you. Mr. Peterson indicated correctly that as a result of our hearing on charter school funding, it was seen as a compromise and would represent a modest increase in their funding, but not as substantial of an increase as the 1.27 would reflect. So it was simply felt to be a compromise.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman and Senator Olson.
Yes, to the sponsor. In your sponsor statement, you alluded to the problem of the UPIC Immersion Charter School suffering a similar fate as the Fairbanks Cochran School. With this new number, how would that affect those two schools?
Effie Cochran has gone beyond the 150 threshold. So they're okay. A few others have also accomplished that. I'm not sure the status of the UPIC one today, to tell you the truth. And I don't know if I have the information handy here, but someone I'm sure can answer that for us. Jerry Jeans, or Eddie Jeans, I keep wanting to call him Jerry, is here to answer any of those kind of questions regarding the technical aspect of it and those that may still be affected. But it just is a lower dollar figure is what it amounts to, similar to what takes place in the regular school system, but it's a rather complex and confusing formula. There's no doubt about that.
Eddie Jeans, could you come forward, please, and Mr. Peterson maybe could come back. You could if you could speak to the question after you identify yourself, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Eddie Jeans. I'm the Director of School Finance for the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development. Mr. Chairman, the UPIC Immersion Program in Bethel has over 150 students in that program, so they are funded as a separate site under the current provisions of law.
We have Senator Olson and Senator Elton.
Along that same line, what's going on with this Nome school?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, the Nome school has remained at about 44 students each year. So they have been receiving supplemental grants outside the foundation program, as well as the Juno charter school and the Fireweed charter school in Homer.
One last question, Mr. Chairman. Going back to the difference between the earlier version and backslash K, I'm assuming that the number adjustments are on the back page of the fiscal note when you go 1.27 to 1.08, which essentially has the four columns there, that those are the changes in the funding levels?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, the fiscal note that the committee currently has is for $648,800, which reflects the changes in law from the current system where they're funded with the largest school in the district to the 1.27. I have a separate fiscal note available for the committee at the 1.08 level, which is a total of $338,900.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, and then Senator Elton, then back to Senator Geisen.
My question was asked and answered. It was Senator Olson's second question.
Okay, Senator Geisen.
Yeah, I think we ought to have the new fiscal note that accompanies the new version that we're attempting to adopt.
You don't necessarily disagree with that. We'll have copies of that made.
And if I might, I really appreciate what's doing here, being done here. Senator Davis was really the initiator of much of our present charter school law. And I remember when I first got elected, she told me that we really needed to revisit it, and there were some real problems in it. And the small schools are really suffering, and they're getting less money than other public schools has been a huge burden for them, and particularly if they've got to rent Class A space anywhere. And some of the districts have reacted in a very, what I consider, an enlightened way, and some haven't. But I'm going to object to the adoption here. It looks like it's about $312,000 difference. And these schools are really performing very well. And they're not only doing the special purpose stuff that's really neat, but many of them are dealing with significantly disadvantaged kids, particularly children with learning disabilities. And I know in my own area, the ones that are dealing with dyslexic kids as a specialized population are just having remarkable success, but they struggle to get to the 150, and that bounces around a lot. And so I will support the original version, which I think was a very enlightened effort.
Okay, we have any comments before we vote on the adoption of the CS? Clerk, just a second. Senator Elm.
And maybe if we could invite Mr. Lampkin back up for a question.
And if you could identify yourself when you go to answer the question, just for the record again, please. Go ahead, Senator Earl.
Mr. Lampkin, I understood the premise of the 1.27, because that attached a figure to, you know, a school size. And I think it was school size of 245 or 275. I can't remember. What was the rationale to get it to 1.08? I mean, is there a nexus between a school size and the 1.08, or is this, how did we get to where we are?
Through the chair, once again, this is Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens. Senator Elton, that figure and these numbers are being drawn right out of the statutes on the school size adjustment. The 1.27 is reflective of a school that's between 75 and 150. 1.08, and Mr. Jeans, I'm sure will correct me if my numbers are off, because I'm going to go for the ballpark here, but 1.08, I believe, would reflect the current slightly modest increase of what the schools are currently getting. And not only, it would put it on the books that we're funding them in that manner, rather than having to come through and fund them with supplemental grants on an annual basis. It would put it in the books. I hope that helps clarify your question.
Well, perhaps if I could follow up. I guess we have a number in the books now, 0.84. I guess I'm trying to figure out what the nexus between 1.08 is with if I understood your answer correctly, there is no school size right now that it's a 1.08, and in fact, with area cost differentials and everything else, I mean, this is just a standard one size fits all for any charter school wherever they are.
Eddie, Mr. Jean, do you want to respond to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The 1.08 is in statute. It's a part of the school size adjustment table, and it's at the next level of schools that are at 150 to 250. And that's the adjustment factor for that range. Currently, the law says if you have under 150 students, you're funded with the largest school in the district. And so, for example, in Juneau, they're funded with the high school at a 0.84. In Kenai, I believe they're with the high school, which is funded at a 0.92. And then in Nome, they're funded actually with the elementary school, which their adjustment is a 0.97. So you can see the three that are below 150 under the current law all have a different adjustment factor. And what this proposal will do is set one adjustment factor for all charter schools below 150. And it's basically a policy call on your part, whether it's 1.27 or 1.08. And where this applies in the formula is to the school size adjustment for ADM. Then they get to go through the formula for the cost factor, the 20% adjustment, and so on. So it will establish a uniform application. Based on the fiscal note at the 1.08, you'll see it provides them with $338,000 above what they currently receive. The highest that the supplementals have been in the past was $250,000 for these charter schools below 150. I'd also like to mention that during the hearing this past weekend, when Senator Stevens was held the hearing for charter schools, he asked each one of these charter schools if they would support the 1.08, and each one of them responded in affirmative.
Go ahead.
And I'm going to make an assumption that I think it's clear to me, but maybe I need to hear it from you, that now that Juneau is splitting its high school and there'll be two high schools, and when you compare it to the largest school in the district, even with two high schools, we don't get any place close to 1.08. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that's correct. The two high schools will still have over 750 students, and they will be at the top of the school size adjustment.
So they would stay at 0.84?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dyson, you have another comment?
Well, this bill didn't appear in any committee that I serve on, so I'm playing catch up here. But I see that the 1.27 is in fact does have a rational base, and that's the rate that apparently is in the law for schools under 275. I note here that the Winterberry School had one in 06 had 143 students instead of 150, and the delta in amount of money they received was $400,000, and it, at least according to the sponsor statement, which I assume is reliable, that really created a significant financial crisis for that student population and school. So I guess I'm going to maintain my objection, and I think that the whole bunch of issues that we're talking about here with failing schools and so on, schools that parents are in charge of have historically done very, very well, and in empowering those to get something like what students in other schools get is just another way that we can support them. And I suspect most of them are into growing, you know, and serving a larger population, and then they will get over the threshold, and this extra boost that we're giving them here when they're bumping along just below the threshold will help them get there.
Senator Thomas, you had a comment, and then Senator Hoffman.
just a quick comment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The adoption.
There is a chart in your packet anyhow for people to see the numbers, and that was exactly what I had calculated and how I'd move forward with it. It is a burden for them. That was the testimony, however, that they would be acceptable to the 1.08. I think it was something's better than nothing kind of situation. So anyhow, we wanted to move forward, and that's where we're at today. So it's up to those of us sitting here at the table to determine whether we move forward that way or not.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a point of verification on the Anvil Science, City Science Academy, under the CS that's before us, they would get funded at 1.97.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, no, they would be funded under the CS at 1.08. They are currently funded at 0.97.
0.97, okay.
Correct.
Thank you.
That's, we're gonna, we can go around for circles. It's getting time here to vote. Senator Olson.
Let me just make sure I got it clear in my head. Under the CS backslash K that's under consideration, Anvil City would be funded at 1.08 as opposed to being funded at 1.27 under the original bill. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that's correct, Senator Olson.
Any other closing comments?
Yeah, I don't want to be a bad team member here, but I object to your wanting to limit debate on issues like this. And but I think it's clear what the argument really has been is us trying to keep the budget down, which is an admirable goal. And Senator Thomas is right that 1.08 is better than nothing, which is exactly what my wife says about me. But I think that what Senator Thomas here has decided to do originally is a rational number and a huge help to these schools, most of which will grow beyond the 150 and not need that.
It's a prerogative of the chair to keep the committee motion in progress so that we don't just circle around a particular item endlessly. The motion here is an objection to the adoption of the CS, and I think Senator Dyson, you've had four opportunities to respond to this particular issue, so I don't think the chair is being unduly and trying to move the discussion around the table and have everybody have the opportunity for clarification, but continue to have the process moving forward. Do we have any other objection or comments, final comments, before we call the clerk? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Elton?
No.
No.
Senator Thomas?
No.
Senator Dyson?
No.
Senator Stedman?
Yes.
Senator Hoffman?
Yes.
We're going to go ahead and set this bill aside for now and go on to the next bill. We're going to go on now to next item on the agenda, House Bill 125. Budget planning, long-range fiscal plan. We've had this issue up before us previously. We've got a CS to hear today and take some public testimony. And at the last meeting, we adopted CS version V, and Senator Hoffman, if we can have a motion for version N.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Senate Finance Committee adopt version M as our working document on House Bill 125.
Okay, and I'll object for comments. Senator, we'll have Mr. Peterson come forward. Mr. Peterson, if you can identify yourself and walk through the CS, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Darwin Peterson, staff to Senator Stedman. The CS before you on House Bill 125 is backslash N, and there were three changes in this CS. First change is on page 1, line 6. We removed the language, quote, except during the first year of the governor's first term of office, unquote. The reason for that change was because we want the fiscal plan to be provided each and every year. Second change is on page 2, line 11 through 15. This is a new section that requires a fiscal plan to include assumptions and projections, especially in the area of major operating increases. An example of how this would be useful would be an expected shift in the population of school-aged children in a community and how that would affect school funding. The third change is on page 4, lines 6 through 12, another new section. It requires the Department of Revenue to submit to the legislature a debt affordability analysis each year by January 31st. Currently, Alaska does not produce a document that meets rating agency requirements for a debt affordability study. Even though the Department of Administration annually publishes the CAFR, the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, that document includes an inventory of state debt, but it lacks projections for future debt issuance and how that would impact our state. So those are the changes, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Okay, do we have any questions? I'll remove my objection to the CS. Do we have any further objection to the CS? Okay, seeing no further objection to the CS, we'll adopt it version N as a working document and the long-awaited arrival of Representative Hawker, who's been waiting quite a few months on this bill for this opportunity. If you could go ahead and walk us through the bill with the changes and how this is the second time we've had this bill up, so Representative Hawker, maybe you could take the opportunity here. We've got about 25 minutes, so we think we have time, but if you could give us a synopsis of this bill again and then the integration of the proposed items and the adopted items that were included in the CS.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman, and my apologies for being late here. We were just wrapping up an LBNA meeting. The bill before us, and I'm trying to just encapsulate it quickly, really represents what I think is a critical step forward in the state in establishing what I consider sort of the holy grail of state policy has been in the last many years, and that is a fiscal plan. A bill really recognizes that the bill itself does not have some sort of a work product that there will be a fiscal plan completed and end of that's the last thing you hear about it. This bill really, in a very simple through a very simple mechanism, establishes a planning process so that everyone that sits at our seats, the legislature seats, and everyone that sits in the administration, and everyone in the public of the state of Alaska who observes our process can understand how we make financial decisions today in the context of the consequences of those decisions over time. So very quickly, what the bill does is require that each year, along with the annual spending plan or the annual budget, the administration submit to the legislature and the public a 10-year estimate, a projection of all future sources and uses of state funds. Key words here are sources and uses. Borrowing money, of course, is a source of funds, but it's not a revenue. So we don't want to talk about revenue and expense. We want to talk about where funds will come from and where they will go to over 10 years. You know, recognizing that projections are inherently wrong. I do not have a perfect crystal ball, nor does anyone. There's nothing in this legislation that creates a false sense of accuracy or false sense of precision. However, I particularly appreciate the amendment that was just added here, where we simply say, like in any good business projection, you have the projection and you have the explanatory notes or the assumptions, the critical assumptions in sufficient detail to understand the fiscal plan. With respect, Mr. Chair, that really was the substance of the bill, and I think in its profound and elegant in its simplicity, truly will establish a situation where I believe as we come back into these seats in future years, we have a much better ability to understand, again, the consequences of the immediate financing decisions we make. The one section that was added by the in this CS that I was done at the with the advice and consent of the Department of Revenue that I think is particularly profound also is that Section 4, which now calls this debt affordability analysis, where that really came from was from the recent Moody's evaluation of the state of Alaska, and I can't put my finger on it immediately here, but it indicated what are the state's deficiencies in public finance. And one of the deficiencies identified by Moody's, of course, in rating our the state's credit and the state's financial capability was to, they said that we do not have what they called a debt affordability study, an annual, we've got some very good things going for the state, but we did not have that debt affordability study. And although recommended slightly different language, Department of Law came back with a paraphrase here that works. But the key thing here is that the market makers, the capital markets in New York, think very highly of a state that, in addition to its, again, its annual budgeting and annually actually does a document which conforms sort of to the rating agency's expectations to include an inventory of state debt, projections of future state public debt, and evaluations of the consequential affordability impacts. And those are the languages directly out of the Moody's report. Again, I think Ledge Legal, in their infinite wisdom, simply doesn't, they never have quite understood financial language, so they turned it into legal language that gets us to pretty much the same place. I think that's something that would be very important to, again, the state as we continue to mature and grow and establish ourselves as a credible public entity in the world financial markets. With that, and then you also see the bill's got a, there's a lot of pages in here simply where we're cleaning up provisions in the Executive Budget Act, again, just conforming existing language to the terms established in this bill. So that, Mr. Chair, is the bill in its, I think, the most simple presentation possible. And I sincerely appreciate your careful consideration. And it really has become a much better product in that we have dealt with it, thought about it for a year and a half, you know, over the 2 years of a legislative session. And as we approach the end of this session, I think with the assistance of this committee and other folks in the Department of Revenue, we've got just an excellent product here.
I think Representative Hawker, dealing with the debt affordability analysis, we're kind of in a paradox here in the state of Alaska where we have a sizable set aside, $37 billion in our permanent fund and substantial other savings, yet at the same time we have a very small debt load on the state of Alaska. But without the inclusion of the debt affordability analysis, the rating agencies still put that as a mark against us in their rating. So this is a methodology then that we could go in and address their rating criteria, even though, you know, we don't have a strangling of debt. In fact, there's as much conversation to reduce debt around here as there is interest in issuing more capital bonds or bonds for some capital improvements.
And Mr. Chairman, if I might, I was able to put my finger on the Moody's report, and absolutely what you have said is exactly the state of Alaska as it's viewed in the capital markets here. This analysis was the March 2008 Moody's Investor Service Global Credit Research Report, which is sort of like the definitive Moody's report on the state of Alaska. And in the governance framework analysis, the point was that the state suffers from several governance shortcomings. But it does say, although our financial management, including a conservative approach to oil forecasting, has led to improved financial strength in recent years, the governance framework that supports the state's financial management is characterized by several shortcomings in what they call the best practices. So what we're really moving here is to remediate these best practices. First point here, and I think it goes directly to the substance of House Bill 125, Alaska does not produce multi-year financial plans without year revenue and expenditure forecasts. That is House Bill 125. And then the second point noted in governance by Moody's is that the state does not produce a document that meets Moody's requirements for a debt affordability study. So we have landed on the two governance best practices shortcomings identified by Moody's with the substance of this bill, and I, again, thank you very much.
We have any questions for the bill sponsor before we take amendments? We have an amendment from one member. Senator Dyson.
Brief at ease.
Sure, brief at ease. going back on the record. If there's any questions for the bill sponsor, we'll take those and then we'll move to amendments. Okay, seeing none, we have an amendment offered by Senator Dyson. Senator Dyson, would you like to move your amendment, please?
Yeah, move the amendment to HB 125.
Okay, and I'll object for discussion. And Senator Dyson, do you want to explain your amendment to the committee, please?
Yeah, I really appreciate both the sponsors bringing this bill forward and the committee hearing it. And we've heard the hue and cry for a long time for us to get to the very point where we have something like this. And I think it's really I commend our efforts. And all this, the amendment does is tighten up some of the language and makes it clear what the law will anticipate will be in the governor's submittal to us. And the bill we have before us says, I think, that it will be adequate. And this just further defines what the legislator expects to be in that document. And and I can discuss any one of the specific things here, but that's the import of what we're doing. And it also says that the report will get to the legislature before the governor's state of the state, so we'll have some time to digest it before she or he speaks to us. That's the last line there on the second page. But this it also expands the period from 10 years to 15. The reason for the 15 years is all of us are expecting that the major development things that will happen that might bring more revenue will probably exceed the 10-year window. And so we're expanding it out to 15 to make sure that the plan bridges that this particular one we're worried about or any ones in the future. So I'd be glad to answer any questions, but I think that in general is what the amendment's about.
We have any questions? Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to know what the bill sponsor thinks of the amendment.
Rep. Hawker, would you like to address that?
Mr. Chairman, I'm thinking as fast as I possibly can here. That's the first I've had the chance to see it.
Hold off on that question until later to somebody else.
I have a preliminary answer, though, Mr. Chair. The issue of 10 and 15 years, with all respect, we've talked about the time frame. 15 years is, I think, gets beyond a reasonable framework of projection. 10 years is probably even stretching it a bit, but the reason we landed on 10 years in the bill is that the current state's revenue forecasting is done on a 10-year model. So I worry a little bit about such a false precision out to 15 years that we end up with a document where people start looking at the last 5 years of the projection and thinking it's real, where, you know, even a 10-year projection, that last 5 years is pretty soft numbers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Elton.
Just a comment and then a question that may be for the executive branch. I mean, I think the 15-year is problematic. I can remember going back two decades later and reading Alvin Toffler's Future Shock book, in which he predicted what the future was going to be, and I think he was probably embarrassed about what his predictions had been, because the world changes so dramatically. But the question, and it's perhaps best answered by the executive, is I look at the requirements here and the detail of the requirements, and I would suspect that the fiscal note changes fairly significantly, because OMB, the charge for OMB is broadly expanded here. And I guess I need to know whether my notion about a change in the fiscal note is correct or not.
Do we have a representative from OMB here?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John Boucher, policy analyst with the Office of Management and Budget. Representative Elton through the chair. I haven't had much longer to look at this than Representative Hawker. However, my initial reactions are similar to yours in that it appears that the scope of work in the fiscal planning document could be significantly expanded. How much I would probably like to take a little longer to take a look at, but I think my initial impressions are that it could be significantly expanded, particularly with items such as changes in strategy or new strategies needed as a result of previously unanticipated changes in expenditures, revenues, or unsuccessful strategies. And so that requires a level of scenario planning that I see just in that particular item that could significantly expand the scope of work.
Rep. Walker, you look like you want to make a comment.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would echo the sentiments of Mr. Boucher, and as I've now had a chance to read through this list of recommendations, this philosophically, well, you know, we've had this discussion, we in this building's gone through committee, and I think even with you folks at the Senate Finance Committee in our previous meeting, again, recognizing we're embarking on a new course here. It was certainly my desire in bringing forth this bill to make it as least constraining a course as possible on the administration, be able to accomplish, you know, provide a tool that we can all use as again, legislators, public, and executive to develop a fiscal planning, you mean more of a specific fiscal plan. Again, this bill, as I emphasize, I've always called it, this bill is about creating a verb, not a noun. This amendment really tries to define the noun that says the end product shall be the following. And respectfully, in this case, and as we're making this change, embarking upon this change, I'm a little hesitant to want to define the outcome. I think we'd be, not that as time progresses and as the legislature sees some of the work product provided by the administration, we may well wish to go back to them and flesh out and say it needs to include the following. But at this part of the process of developing a fiscal planning process, I'm really hesitant to provide this rather specific list of components, of outcomes. And there's another point about when you define a list of outcomes, even though you may preface it with the sort of vague language that, well, it may include other things, this then becomes the entire focus. And sometimes it's to the exclusion of other matters that might be quite relevant.
Okay, thank you. Final comments, Senator Dyson?
Not necessarily my final comments, but certainly this amendment does not expand the scope of the work. Your bill says it will be adequate, and I would challenge you to show any of these things here that shouldn't be a part of an adequate projection of where we're going here with a fiscal plan. There's nothing here that limits at all what the administration will produce or what the legislature can ask for. And I would note for the record that BP, British Petroleum, has a 50-year plan. Brazil has an 80-year plan. European Union is considering right now, maybe as we speak, a 20-year plan. And I do not think that it is inappropriate for us to ask for 15. And remember that once the plan is done, then all the work is needed every year is just to update it. You know, how close did we get to reducing our debt to what our target was? How should we reevaluate our strategies? And I stand by the amendment. Thank you.
Do we have any final comments on adoption of amendment number one? The chair maintains the objection to adoption of amendment number one. Clerk, call the roll.
Could you explain the we're voting on adoption?
We're voting on the adoption of amendment number one offered by Senator Dyson, and the chair recommends a no vote.
That clarifies it. Thank you. No.
Call the roll.
Senator Thomas?
No.
Senator Dyson?
Yes.
No.
Senator Hubbard?
I'm going to abstain. I wasn't here for the presentation.
Yeah, that's...
Senator Olson?
No.
Senator Bachman?
No.
Senator
Stedman? No. Amendment number one fails. I think that's all. Is there any other amendments? So we have before us version N, and I see You know, there's two folks that signed up for OMB, both to testify, so I don't know if OMB wants to make some comments on this bill before the committee takes action.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, if we could make just a couple of brief comments specifically to the changes in the committee substitute.
In the entire bill, if you'd like.
Okay. Senator Stedman and members of the Finance Committee, we are in support of this bill as written. I think the changes that have been proposed in the committee substitute, generally we are in full support of. We do have one thing that we'd like to draw to your attention, though, related to the changes in online six, where previously it said except during the first year of an administration. Our objection really lies in the fact of, you know, when the mechanics of when a new administration comes in. Oftentimes they're submitting the previous administration's budget in the first iteration, and it could be that administration was elected based upon opposition to the fiscal plan that's in place of the previous administration. And so we'd just like to point that possibility out. It could be that if because of the timing of the submission of the fiscal plan, that the incoming administration would essentially strip many of the provisions of the previous administration's fiscal plan. For example, in the last change of administration, the director of OMB wasn't even on board until January 15th. And so oftentimes the focus in that first administration is just gearing up rather than being able to plan. Certainly they would have their, want to put their own stamp, so to speak, on the fiscal plan. So that would be our only concern with this particular change.
Representative Hawker, is the interpretation correct that the administration, an incoming administration, could subsequently file an amendment to the plan?
Mr. Chairman, certainly there is nothing here that would prohibit submitting the previous administration's plan and then amending it. In fact, as I recall, I believe, was it 5 years ago when the Murkowski administration came in, we got carryover budgets and then a new budget submitted after they were in place. So very much so, sir. My own perspective on the requiring this each and every year is that I think it is important that the legislature send a message to those with aspirations to be the governor of this great state, that when they come into office, they should be prepared to lead and they should have a vision for the state to go forward with. And that I don't think we need, the incoming administration should be prepared to lead the moment they're elected and not ask for a year to figure out what's going on.
And I think that's some of the conversations we had in looking at removing that language to require a continuation of the ongoing plan, with the thoughts that a new administration may do substantial amendments after they've had time to get in and digest the state of the state. Do we have any other comments on the bill? Senator Dyson.
Yeah, I think the point made is a good one. I watched this administration really struggle between November and January to get spun up on all this, and as long as we have that understanding that that first piece of work is subject to some revision, you know, I think that's fine. And I want to make sure that I want to compliment the sponsor on this. It's an excellent piece of work. Maybe a couple of decades late, but very well done.
Okay. We have any other final comments before we ask for the will of the committee? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Senate Finance Committee pass out Senate CS for House Bill 125 Finance with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Version N.
Version N. We've already adopted that, yes.
Okay, we have a motion on the table to move the bill from committee version N. Senate CS for House Bill 125 version N. Attach fiscal notes and individual recommendations. And do we have objection? Okay, seeing no objection, we will move this bill from committee. That concludes today's work, and we will reconvene tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Yep, tomorrow morning, 9 a.m. Meeting adjourned.
No, 1:30?
There is no afternoon meeting today. We're adjourned.